This is called Making Yourself Indispensable to Editors, and I was going to call it How to Make $1 Million a Year Freelancing, but Madeline thought we ought to be more truthful than that. And even when I was interviewing an editor to get some comments for this, the editor said, no writer is indispensable to an editor. So you try to come up with these titles, and what happens? But what I'm hoping to do today is give you some comments from the horse's mouths. Past week I called up some editors at Christianity Today, Christian Herald, Contemporary Christian Music, Campus Life, and somebody else. And I said, editor, what makes writers indispensable to you? And they told me. So we're going to hear some of that. And then we're also going to talk about some of the steps or activities writers can do to give the editors what they need to serve the editors properly. And then I'm going to save some time at the end to do some questions and answers and go over some things. And if you've got a notebook, if I could propose something to you, one is using your front page to take some notes on the comments I'm going to get from the editors, just to jot down ideas. You know, when in movies, when they got somebody getting psychiatric counseling or therapy, they do that free association thing where they say, I'm going to tell you a word, and you tell me what bells that rings in your mind. They say, father, and, you know, you say beast or whatever, and then, you know, they go back and forth. That's what I'd like you to do on the first page, is just write down things that pop up as I read the comments from the editors. On the second page, if you could just put a question mark on top of there and keep track of issues that emerge in your mind that you may want to ask about or some things you have questions about. And on the third page, what I would like you to do, if you would be so kind, is to draw a line down the middle of the page, either horizontally or vertically, I don't care, and put a plus in one half and a minus in the other half, and sometime toward the end, tell me what I did right and wrong.
Number one, you were here.
All right, I'll take anything I can get at this point. But I think one thing about writing something is that you can do a draft and you can examine it and then you can send it off and then you can see what the editor does to it, and if it's controversial enough, you can hear what readers said about it. But when you say things, you can't really do that. I mean, you can listen to a tape, but that's not much fun. But I would appreciate you folks jotting some things down, telling me what a great guy or scumbag I am. Let me write down a word before I get to the editor's comments. If I was given 30 seconds and had to crystallize everything I think is important about writing into one word, I would elaborate on this word, audience. I think a lot of writers, and I think Bill Anderson was talking about this morning, and also Tracy Mullen was in her seminar this morning, a lot of writers start with themselves and work outward. A relative has died, and they're grieving. So they talk about the grieving process from a very individualistic kind of point of view. Or whatever it is, they start with themselves. What I think good writers need to do is start with their audience first and then work backwards from there. What does your audience want? What do they need? How complicated can they take it? Is this a mass audience, or is it a specialized audience? Okay, is it a Christian Herald or something that reaches a lot of people, or a newspaper? Or is it a smaller thing that focuses in on theology for pastors, or Christian musicians for, you know, younger audiences, or campus life for, you know, high school or college kids? So what's your audience there? Also, what's their theology? Are you writing for your denominational publication, and so you know what that universe is, or are you writing for a lot broader audience, so you can't use some of the words that mean one thing to your group and another thing to another group? And how deep do they want to go theologically? How light or heavy is the reading? I mean, is it a Reader's Digest kind of thing? Or is it a leadership journal type of publication. You know, you need to figure out your audience there. And I think there's three basic audiences we need to think about. Readers is one. God is another one. I put God in parentheses, not because he's not important, but because he either subscribes to everything or nothing. I mean, I don't see God reading magazines, but I see him being audience for our thoughts and our, you know, what we write, what we think before we're even aware we're thinking it sometimes. But I think the most important audience is editors. Because you can have a great idea, or think you do, anyway, for a great story, for this audience up here, the readers, but your first hump you have to get over to get to that audience is this audience, the editors. And so one of my hopes today is that we will have a little more sympathy for the trials and tribulations of editors, the situations they find themselves in, the challenges they face, and that as writers we'll be able to get through them to these people. And we could maybe put another audience down there, our bank teller, where we take these huge checks after we get to all these people, but that's another seminar. Just briefly about me, the brochure says something crazy about me having written 400 or more articles, and I think that's true. I used to say less than 500, but I need to count them. But it's a lot. 80-some publications and more than 100 editors, because editors come and go, or sometimes at some publications you work with more than one editor. So that's a lot of heavy numbers. But also, I've been an editor. I was editor of my student daily at the college I went to, Wright State University, in Dayton, Ohio, which was a secular college, which was very interesting. I was the editor of a monthly business publication in Dayton. I was editor of Bookstore Journal for a while. I'm currently editor of Compassion Update for Compassion. And also serve as a contributing editor of Wittenberg Door. That's not something I tell everybody. But I figured I could tell you guys that. And have one book on rock music, The Heart of Rock and Roll, which is about 10 Christian artists. I'm working on a devotional book for Zondervan. And working on a curriculum project for David C. Cook. And back in Ohio, I worked for an engineering firm and wrote proposals for interactive computer graphics and photogrammetric mapping. And if you know what those are, I'll give you a nickel. But, so I've had to take extremely technical stuff and translate it to audiences of city managers and military base purchasing agents and things like that. I've communicated with a lot of editors. I've also been an editor and gotten a lot of slop on my desk. So it's kind of, I think I understand how editors feel sometimes. And before I go on, I need to find out who you guys are. Could I see the hands of those people who have had something published? Hey. Okay, how about the hands of those people who have had five or more things published? What about 10 or more? I'm going to keep going.
Do hundreds of press releases count? Or are you talking about really published stuff?
They count.
I didn't define it, so I'd say go for it. What about 25 or more? This is getting embarrassing. 50? I think we better just quit right now. Okay, some of the things I'm saying about reaching this audience of editors is talking about building relationships with editors. Now, some of you on your question page may need to back me up at the end and talk about how do we get to a point where we even have a relationship with an editor. So I may be jumping off at the wrong point, but I will try to leave some time at the end where if I missed some crucial first steps, you'll let me know. Okay. I did have some notes here from editors. These guys really went wild. I have three and a third pages of notes from editors. Well, three and a fifth. If I was getting paid for it, I would have expanded that a little bit more. But what I would like you to do is not try to take all this stuff down, but just kind of free associate listen to what these folks are saying and jot down like key words, key phrases, key concepts. And I'm going to kind of go through these slowly enough, I hope, for you to get them. But then we will come back and use our highly developed analytic skills to figure out what all this stuff actually means. Let's start with John Still, editor of Contemporary Christian Magazine. No writer is indispensable. So I guess we can go to the other seminars. The people who always come through for me are the ones that I tend to think of. Those people who are flexible, who always make deadlines, who develop ideas on their own, who are flexible in terms of what they can do. People who I know understand our magazine. When a writer understands our publication, I don't have to spend a great deal of time educating him or her about an assignment. Also, John said, if I've assigned you a piece and I have planned space for that piece, then I need to run that piece. Okay, Diane Ebley, assistant editor at Campus Life. Writers really need to understand the publication and what they're trying to do and be able to write in that vein. People we depend on a lot, which is relatively few, that's the number one thing. They understand us. They understand there's a particular area our magazine does, and they help us develop that. For example, Marcia Marks, who's a contributing editor, helps us with humor. Ideas are sometimes hard for us to come by. She has pinpointed that need and helped us to develop humor. Once writers establish a relationship with us and we know we can depend on them, we do depend on them. Diane also says when they query, get to the point and make sense and show that they understand our magazine. And Diane also says, don't be discouraged if it takes us a while to get back to you. That might even be a good sign if it takes a while to get back to you. But I can't promise anything. She was quick to add. After 6 weeks, call and delicately say, have you seen my query or manuscript? If the writer is sensitive about it, we don't mind. Dean Merrill, editor of Christian Herald. The indispensable people to me are really consistent producers who, when you ask to do something, it's going to hit the mark. They ask enough questions, they read your magazine enough, and they know what you want. Example, Sandy Larson from Ashland, Wisconsin. It's going to be bright, it's going to be concise, it's going to go in a straight line and not zigzag logically. Another example, Dave Jackson. I'd given him a deadline the 1st of July. Yesterday morning, the thing was on my desk. He must have a mortgage payment coming up. He'd thought of all the things you wanted to ask people. You could believe these folks. They weren't out in left field. They weren't too good to be true. I can believe those stories, and people will really respond to them. He included phone numbers for the subject so photographers could find them. Everything was put together. I bumped his payment up from $300 to $425. I'm not offering any shortcuts. Just hit the bullseye. This is much better than listening to me, isn't it? I should just... Susan Machenick of Discipleship Journal. Meet the deadlines, which hardly anyone does. The deadline for our September issue is April 1st, and I only have 2 of the 5 assigned theme articles. When querying, send as much information as possible. Write a detailed query. An outline is even better. Clips are good if you haven't worked with us before. Err on the side of sending too much rather than too little. Susan also says, the big thing is study the magazine before you send anything in. Let me know that you've studied it by saying something intelligent. By saying something that communicates that you're not just sending it off to everybody listed in Christian Writers Market. Examples of those kind of comments are, I noticed you seem to have articles that do such and such. I read in your writer's guidelines that you prefer such and such. Susan also says, one lady I really appreciate, every manuscript she sends in is spotless. Looks like she just put a new ribbon in her printer. And her name is Marilyn Andrus or something like that. We've published one of her articles. She sent a lot we haven't used, but everything is carefully documented and footnoted. I give her manuscripts more attention. I see that that person has really put themselves into it, as opposed to last week. Well, this isn't the best work I've done, but here it is. Susan had a lot to say. I hit her hot button on this, I think. Try to do anything you can do to put yourselves in the editor's shoes. I think there she's getting at the editor as an audience. By not sending more than one manuscript at a time, unless they're really short. Don't make your editor work harder than they would have to by forcing them to read stuff single-spaced, barely legible, illogical, etc., etc. Don't ask for special help. For example, she had a writer who said, if you don't use this, could you suggest where I could send it? Or people ask for critiques. I'm just a beginning writer and I really don't know how to do this. Could you help me out? Susan says they expect you to educate them. I'd love to do it and I love to help people, but I just can't. I don't have the time. Susan also said, well, we all have Susan here or something. Learn how to write a good query letter. Hardly anybody writes a good query letter. A good one tells me why the topic is important. It shows me that the person has a good understanding of our audience. It gives me an idea about the style and approach the person is going to take to the topic. The letter should be able to capture and describe the article. It should be well written. The only impression I have of what this person can do is this letter. And if they're sloppy with it, I really don't want to trust them with an article. Be thorough. Give me an accurate word count. Tell me when you can have the article to me. Tell me where you've published before, if you have. If you haven't been published, it's not a bad thing. But if you have, it's positive. Don't give me a huge list of your qualifications, including everything you've done since junior high school. I want to know if you have any special expertise in the subject. You don't have to have graduated from high school, but I want to know you can write and that you know about this. PhDs are some of our worst people. And finally, Lynn Kreiderman, news editor, Christianity Today. Become an expert. Find a niche that you care to learn a great deal about, so whenever I think about that subject, I think of you. There are a lot of areas out there people could be becoming more expert in. That would be one good way different writers could help us. Lynn also said, an editor from the New Yorker once said, get it to me at the right time and the right length. It doesn't have to be any good, but I'll use it. Editors have space and time requirements, plus we're as lazy as anybody else. If it fits and it's on time, and if it's not bad junk, I might use it. And do it exactly as you were told. Lynn also said, develop a tremendous sense of curiosity so that the kinds of ideas you query me with are irresistible. Writers should have a highly developed sense of curiosity. For them, their curiosity allows them to take an ordinary thing and turn it into a story I call a sleeper, which is a story nobody else notices but Christianity Today does. He cited an example, the magazine Insight. Anybody know about that magazine?
Yes.
The publisher is?
I can't remember his name.
Unification Church is the publisher. The Moonies.
There's one fellow that's behind it.
Yeah.
His name is nationally known for something.
Right. It's a great publication. But he says, they always seem to report on things the other news magazines miss. They have good stories, very interesting, very important. We would like to do more of these kinds of stories, and any editor would like to think they do these kinds of stories. So I see a lot of full notebook pages. I love that kind of stuff. Why don't you take 30 seconds, look at all those wonderful ideas you just wrote down, and see if there are some that recur frequently. And see if there are some that really jumped out at you. Maybe try to get your two or three greatest hits off of that list and kind of save those, and we will talk about some of those.
Surprised that one editor said, call him after 6 weeks.
and ask, you know, nicely, where is my manuscript, or have you seen it? I didn't think they wanted calls unless you get to know them well.
That was the only one of five people who said that. So that may be not average.
Something.
But one thing I do in a query letter is say, if I don't hear from you by, you know, within 3 weeks, I'll call you on Monday, the May 16th or whatever. And that way they know it's coming. Okay, you guys are quick and analytic. What is one thing that somebody saw that was recurring? Yes.
No, the publication.
Hey, I heard that myself. And that really relates to editors as an audience, doesn't it? I think a lot of editors feel like they sweat and toil over this thing, they send it out there, they ship it, and nobody reads it. And it particularly infuriates them when people who are trying to write for them don't read it. How many references do we have of that?
I think probably four.
Okay, four, maybe five. Anybody else find a hot button?
Dependable.
Sorry?
Dependable.
Okay, dependable. And in some cases, dependable as opposed to artsy-fartsy or something like that. And it's interesting, that may contradict almost or seem to with what Bill Anderson was saying this morning about how we can't produce less than the best or something. But I think some of these people, particularly the Christianity Today's, who are on a biweekly schedule and have a news section to fill up pretty quickly, I think they are more prone to send out assignments, and their main criteria is getting it back by, you know, within 10 days. Or something. I know the first thing I did for them, I had like 5 days to turn around. That was a pretty complicated piece, and that really helped that I could do that. Any other hot buttons? Yes?
The query letter was mentioned.
Okay. And that is something maybe we can get back to in a little more detail. Now, this is where the people in the front two rows need to stand up and do the watuti for the photographer. I'm just kidding. Any other hot buttons?
Developing ideas.
Okay.
Yeah, curiosity and flexibility. Did those go to that too?
Let's spread them out. We got all this white space here.
Meet the deadline.
Okay. And that seems like such a basic thing. But didn't Susan Machenik's comment, it surprised me when she said it. It also surprised me that she didn't say, I don't want you to repeat that to anybody. Because that's kind of, and that is a pretty long deadline. You get the impression maybe if it's a September issue and their deadline is April, maybe they're allowing for that. And maybe over years it's been communicated to writers that April isn't really the deadline. It's more like June or July. And maybe that's a communication problem. But how do you feel at work, or wherever you are, when you're expecting something to happen, or somebody's promised to you it would happen and it doesn't happen? You have stress, you have discomfort. You may have to spend more time in the office making a secondary plan to take care of that foul-up, or you may have to create something yourself, heavens to the Murgatroyd. So those are pretty important. Anything else, hot buttons? Yeah, Mary?
What the manuscript looks like.
Okay. Can I call that manuscript quality? Is that okay? Any other hot buttons?
Make it as easy for the editor as possible.
Okay. And I thought Lynn Kreiderman's comment at CT was interesting. We're as lazy as anybody else. And he's not a lazy guy, but I think writers have ideas of editors as these, you know, superhuman intellectual wizards or something like that, who aren't troubled by messy stuff and stuff that's hard to read or understand. Anything else?
Be an expert in an area.
Okay. Now, this is something I have exploited for last... I realized that in March... Last March was my 10th anniversary for my first published article. Yeah, the first one was for my student newspaper on the French jazz violinist Jean-Luc Ponty. Anybody ever heard of him? And so I figured, hey, this music thing is working. But I was able to write about Christian musicians, and that was the first thing I did for CT, was something on Keith Green after he died back in 82 or whenever. But after you do a few music things and handle them okay, you're allowed to say to the guy, hey, bud, I'm broader than this. You know, give me something else. But you have to start somewhere. And I think that's one thing writers can do is spend some time with themselves. What are the things that maybe they aren't even intellectual? You know, maybe I just have an interest in knitting. Or maybe we collect antique spittoons or whatever it is. But there's something that you probably know a lot about more than other people. And if you can develop that into something where you write about it and convince editors of that, that's an important first step and one you can build on from there. And, of course, if your expertise area is spittoons, the frequency with which you get assignments from Christianity Today may not be that great. And you might even develop a few expertise areas. But I think when an editor assigns something to you as opposed to the other 500 willing writers, they want to have a sense of confidence that you are the person who can do a good job on that. Anything else?
Well, the word intelligence kind of popped out at me, that an editor would be looking for someone who can communicate intelligently.
Okay. But, going back to Susan Mationick, which kind of people were her worst writers?
PhDs,
so...
Too intelligent.
Yeah, or at least not sounding like it. And last weekend, I had an old roommate visit me from Ohio, and he had me read his 120-page thesis on some kind of third-world developmental economics and how the Marxist and the institutionalist paradigms were not... and it was just... It was a real struggle for me. I mean, I used to churn that stuff out with the best of them, but... And his audience in that case was... Well, let's be frank. Other eggheads, okay? So he was writing for his audience, but I think you need to balance intelligence with picking up a copy of USA Today every once in a while and seeing where people are. You know what I mean? I'm sorry. Mary, were you going to say something?
Oh, one other thing I thought came through is irresistible ideas.
Okay.
Lots of times we think we keep writing the same subject over and over again.
But if we write for the same subject over and over again, that's all right as long as we throw a different slant on it.
Right.
I guess how you develop your area of expertise.
And when you start talking about qualities... I'm sorry?
I just turned around to see who that person was, to see if she agreed. I didn't want to just squelch her. I didn't mean to
do that
at all.
I don't think you felt squelched, did you? Okay. But that's nice.
Give him a plus on the inside of the page here.
Editor exhibits human qualities.
I nominate... No, I nominate Margie as chairman of the anti-squelch committee. A second? Okay. All right. Couple comments on irresistibleness. That's getting out, in a sense, of the area of traditional editorial concepts of accuracy, factuality, documentation. It's kind of getting into the other area of marketing, almost. It's the sizzle as opposed to the steak and some of those kind of things. It's benefits as opposed to features. You guys know the features benefits deal? Let's say you are writing an advertisement for a lawnmower, and this lawnmower happens to have a 20-inch blade. Let's make it 30-inch blade, okay? Huge blade. The feature is that it's a 30-inch blade, but the benefit to that blade is what? Yes. It's a wider swath, fewer trips back and forth across the yard. See the feature benefit? And I think a lot of riders take a real kind of factual orientation to their ideas. And they're, frankly, they're kind of boring. But again, thinking of your editor as the first audience, you have to convince the editor that this is an irresistible thing, not only for the editor, but that the audience will find this irresistible. And what kind of people do you find more irresistible? Sad people or happy people? Glum people or... you see what I'm saying? I think a lot of people, when they write to editors or call editors, they don't invest enough time and energy into a greeting or closing of a letter that really makes that person glad they read that letter. I mean, they just start going for the jugular vein. Hey, this is a great story. I know you'll love it. And they don't say, you know, hi, I'm glad, you know, to have an opportunity to write to you again. And they don't close by saying, thanks a lot for taking a few minutes to read this letter. You know, I know you're busy and here you are reading my letter. But think about ways you can make yourself come across as an irresistible person to an editor in your communication with that person. And also, I think when you write the article, don't just assume that if it's factual, accurate, and neat, people are going to want to read it. Again, I hate to say it, Rosemary, but pick up a USA Today and see how they write things and package things. I mean, you can read about the whole world in 30 seconds, right? Mm-hmm. And that's appealing to some of us. Yes, Margie.
I was going to say I thought editors were such busy people that they really wouldn't go for something like that, for the friendliness.
Well, sometimes when you do that, it gives you less space on that page for your idea. But my experience is that if something's going to pass through my life, whether it's a letter or a phone call or a person, I feel better about the source of that if it's warm and positive as opposed to just neutral or negative.
Is there a difference in length on a query letter or a cover letter? Or would they both be? How long would you want to spend reading it?
I think that's a function of how well I know you and things like that. And I think if you could... what time does this thing stop? 2:15? Mm-hmm. Can I appoint you chairman of the Time Awareness Committee?
You could, but I don't have a watch.
Okay. But you're willing to serve. I like that. Well, at 5 till 2, could somebody say, okay, bub, let's talk about reality here, okay? Start making some wild gesticulations or something. But I don't want to get off the idea track, and there's one more thing I want to do with some of these ideas before I get into something that specific. Is that okay? Does she feel squelched? Okay. Any other hot buttons that we haven't hit on yet? Because there's one more thing we have to do with this list before we can get away from it. I think... Oh, I'm sorry?
I was thinking of... somebody was saying that they didn't like an article to zigzag, and that logic seems really important. Readability.
Okay. I like the term flow. Can I use... Would
sure.
You feel squelched if I use that term?
Fewer letters.
Which is a function of, again, that's getting out of your mind and everything you know about this great subject, but taking the reader and whatever he or she knows or doesn't know, starting them at point A and getting them through to point G or H or L or whatever, without them at point C saying, what? Where? Who? You know, and thinking from their shoes. And also making each section build on the other and using transitions. One thing I do a lot of is that if I have something of a certain length, I divide it up, you know, I figure out what my ideas are and create subheads and just write shorter sections using subheads and transitions as bridges. Because each subhead, you've already given the reader a pat on the back, they've gotten through section one, here's a nice piece of bold type, and there's another nice manageable section. Instead of having to wade from A through L without any little pats on the backs or anything like that. What I'd like you to do next is take 2.5 minutes and look at all these great things and come up with 2 or 3 steps you can take, beginning with action verbs. If you're trying to do these things for an editor, give me 3 things you can do, beginning with action verbs, that accomplish a couple of these most important things. And think of the best, most irresistible action verb you can think of. Does that make sense? You know, put these great concepts into steps you as a writer can take tonight when you go home and write that letter. I know you guys are sharp and analytical and you already have some great ideas. Would anybody like to volunteer 1 action verb thing?
On the query letter, I think you said it. You said go home and write that letter.
Hey, I like that. I like do it even better because 2 words, it's active, it's, you can see it with an apostrophe, I mean an exclamation point after it. So do it is 1.
Query first.
Okay. Can we think of another? The word query just kind of bugs me. Nothing personal, but
tantalize.
That's getting there. I like that. But a query. You see how, if I'm an editor, I would rather receive this tantalizing thing than a query. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Anything else? Action verb. Ed.
Brainstorm and prioritize.
Okay. And I think this brainstorm stuff, I mean, I think there's a lot to that. And I have some comments about that too, but I think a lot of writers don't take the steps they need to take to be more on top of things than the average Joe Blow. And in my opinion, the average Joe Blow is not on top of that many things these days in America. There are too many diversions and too many easy things to do. Yes?
Investigate.
Okay.
Publication of ideas.
I like that. Yes?
Dream, devour, and deliver.
I have a feeling your high school yearbook is going to be great next year. Yeah, I like that. That's great. Yes, Carol?
Relating to an editor, I was thinking of simplifying his life by knowing the magazine and developing your own idea.
Okay. And simplicity, that's an appealing thing. I think we all go for things that simplify our lives.
I think of persuade, you know, as the editor.
I agree. And you can get heavy-handed with that, but I think we ought to be aware that this is someone we can hopefully move rather than just assuming they love everything that comes across their desk. Anything else?
I have a long sentence, but I think you like it.
Okay.
I know you will. Buy and read fastidiously the magazine you propose to attack with manuscript.
I like that.
I knew you would. Thanks for not squelching.
Am I right? Did I not squelching?
I was going to say peruse publication.
Right.
Well, we could have a lot of fun with this, you know, do the alliteration and all this kind of good stuff. Well, I think that's enough of those, because I know our time committee is going to stop me and I have to run through some things. But these are just some things that come off of the top of my mind. Or I should ask, does anybody feel squelched that they had a really good active verb that we did not use? Okay. And these are getting kind of conceptual, which is why we'll have to get back to basic stuff in about 10 minutes. But something that never ceases to amaze me is the fact that we're in a world of change. You've got population changing, political boundaries and leaders changing, cost of gold, the status of the stock market, Supreme Court decisions on American Indians' religious property and putting highways through same, Reagan's using astrologers, on and on and on. This is a crazy planet. And you remember that book, Future Shock, came out like, that was like 15 years ago. And even back then, he was saying that we were being assaulted by overchoice. And that maybe people don't want to go into a grocery and have like 5,000 different kinds of sugared cereal to choose from. It just kind of gets to you. Or what Bill was saying about the cat food this morning. And some people have said that change has changed. The pace with which things change is changing. And change is happening at a quicker pace. Look at the world of journalism. You know, I argue that you had the Industrial Revolution, the Information Revolution, and who's the guy that wrote the book, Amusing Ourselves to Death? Neil Postman, educational guy, used to write a lot of books. He wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, which I think you ought to read. He says we've just gone through a third revolution, from typographic world to visual world. And think about that. I mean, we are all Christians. We all believe in the Word of God. We're all pretty verbal kinds of people. But is our society verbal? No, it's visual. Look at changes in television and journalism. You know, watch 2020, West 57th. Has anybody ever seen West 57th on Saturday nights? Watch the rapidity with which these shots move from this shot to that shot. I mean, if you catch one that's 3 or 4 seconds long, you're doing good. That's a long shot. It's constantly shifting. If you haven't done it, watch MTV sometime. Go to somebody's house and watch it for 45 minutes. Look at changes in magazines. 5 years ago, well, 5.5 years ago, there was no such thing as USA Today. Now it's second most highly read paper in the country, and it has influenced papers all across the country, including the Gazette Telegraph. Mm-hmm. In fact, tonight I'm in the Colorado Springs Press Club, which after you guys all get involved with the Christian Writers Club, you need to get involved with the Press Club. But we're having our roast tonight, and I'm doing a roast segment on the GT Today. And what I did was I went through and cut out all the photos and like rubber cemented them, so I've got like 5 pages of nothing but photos. And it's going to be funny. But a lot of magazines are redesigning. And I heard Harold Myra, publisher of Christianity Today Incorporated, once say that CT, Christianity Today, replaces 100,000 readers every year. And their circulation is only 180,000, 200,000. So that's a lot of folks going through that subscription revolving door. Also, editors move around a lot. Every time a new magazine gets a new editor, that might indicate a new editorial climate. It would inject a new element into editorial committee meetings. So what I'm saying is that things are changing. In a sense, that's very disturbing and stress-causing in a lot of our lives. But it's also an opportunity for us, each time that door revolves, to get in there the next time it's going around. But some things never change. Editors need stories. Editors can't keep up with everything. I mean, they are in this changing world, too. And if you think them being an editor means they can read every magazine they want to, that's not true. There are probably vast amounts of information that they can't even digest. Did anybody see the new Christianity Today? I just got it in my mailbox yesterday. Had a woman from China on the cover who just written a book about living in China. Up on the cover it says, New Age Invades Business, for a news story. And that news story is not in there, which bugged me because I wrote that. But the editor was in Cuba and the assistant, something didn't happen. But that is an article that I queried CT about after having read an 8-page article in Fortune magazine, which was called, man, I don't even remember what it was called, but it was about New Age consulting groups doing management training in large corporations and how a lot of workers were just absorbing all this philosophical baloney and not even knowing what it is, and how some Christians are doing lawsuits after they get the story. Nobody's making a big secret out of it. But CT's news editor hadn't seen that and apparently hadn't been alerted to it by anybody else. So that was something that I got to read in one magazine he didn't that month, and I was able to query him on that. Editors need help all the time. It may not always be the kind of help where you have a story idea and they assign you to do the story. But you are out there in a portion of the world that they are not, and you are aware of things and are in touch with things. Sometimes I have phone conversations with editors in which we discuss trends and ideas and things that are happening, and they assign that to somebody else, or they are already going to assign it to somebody else, but I can suggest an additional contact to them that that other writer could interview for the article, which doesn't give me any money, but it increases their feeling that maybe I'm a good guy to talk to every once in a while. So I think, you know, things are really moving quickly, but some things never change, and that's editors' dependence on people. And I think we get back to the dependability and those kind of things. If you can be that kind of person, if you can be an island of stability in the flotsam and jetsam of life. Oh, I'm sorry. A couple points on beginning a relationship with an editor. And again, we can get back to some of the specifics of queries and things like that. Is that if you've never published anything, we'll bring that up in a couple minutes, but if you have published a couple things and feel like you're okay as a writer, sometimes I suggest a query phone call where you call Joe editor and say, Joe, I'm thinking about proposing this to you or your magazine. What should I do? Would you like a query letter? Would you like a proposal, an outline? Let them tell you what kind of thing they want. And then follow it explicitly, because if they tell you and you blow it, they probably aren't going to trust you with an article. And then, whether you've made a query call or whether you just write a letter, I suggest a great letter that is irresistible and tantalizing and warm on a human level, some kind of presentation of qualifications, and as I think it was Susan Mashenick again who said, I don't want to know everything you've done since junior high. In fact, if you tell me everything you've done since junior high, I may get the feeling that, A, either you haven't really done anything important, or B, you can't figure out what's important and what's not. So go through there and just be ruthless with yourself and figure out what things that you have done would appeal to this person. I basically just have a 2-page listing of publications I've written for, and I just send that. I figure that'll work. Make specific queries. Maybe if it's your first time through, just do one and hit them with your best shot. But if this is somebody you have communicated with in the past, maybe you can toss a couple queries in one letter. When I submitted the New Age in Business piece to CT, I sent a query letter 2 pages long with 11 ideas. But that was because I knew he appreciated abbreviation. And it was kind of an approach that if you want me to elaborate on these, I'd be glad to, but here's some things I've been thinking about. Let me know. And plan for some kind of follow-up. Like I said at the beginning, I'll give you a call Monday, May, maybe since this is the 5th and this is the 7th. Monday will be the 9th. Let's make it the 30th. Is there a 30th in May?
Yes.
Okay. That gives them 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, something in there. That seems like a nice time period to me, because if it goes on too far beyond that, you may have been buried under the shifting sands of history, never to be heard from again. But this way, they've had a chance to get it in. They'll know if it's hot or not. And that way, they can get back to you quickly if it's so bad they don't even want to get your phone call. So plan for some kind of follow-up. And I suggest thinking of ways that you can serve an editor. And I think at Compassion International, where I work, we've been having a management consultant come in. He's doing 3 full-day sessions with some of our managers and directors over the period of a couple weeks. He commented on the fact that even in secular business management literature, the concept of leader as servant is kind of emerging. And it's a very scriptural principle. But I think a lot of American workers have seen too much of, you know, the boss is a guy who's just out to get his Porsche and everything else, phooey on the workers. You know, the Eastern Airlines thing going on right now may be a good indication of that. But leader as servant. And I think also as writers, think of yourself as a servant to an editor. I mean, not only because it makes sense to you, but also because think of this poor guy. He's been supposedly called by God to be in this position to influence his audience with all these things. And maybe you can help him do that in a broader way. So here's some things, just some ideas about how you can serve editors. Give them a slice of life they may not be aware of. I liked what Lynn Kreiderman said. He was the guy who talked about the curiosity and developing something that, you know, is a sleeper. I was reading a magazine last night, Editor and Publisher, which is a weekly that covers the newspaper business. Their New York Newsday, which is a newspaper, has a columnist, Jim Dwyer, and his beat is riding the subways of New York. And you can read this. This is too bizarre to believe. The guy always wanted to write a column. The editor said, what about a subway column? So he rides the subways and writes about people he runs into and things like that. Now, in New York, there's probably a market for subway stories. I mean, people, they just dread it, and it's nice to read something funny about it. But that's an idea of a slice of life that we all take for granted that a writer can turn into something. And I challenge you to do that as you're walking through life. Not to just keep your head down, but look around. And you know, I haven't seen any good articles on trash disposal lately and trash trucks. Maybe you could sell that to somebody. I still haven't seen anybody write an article about the local Christian Motorcyclist Club. Why not? Where are you people? Don't you see that in the newspaper where they have the clubs and activities? Get on a motorcycle and go out with those guys, right?
Somebody that's in it.
There you go. I think that's a great story. I was in an airport and met the president of the Christian Bowhunters Association. And that was my initial reaction, which I had to squelch because I didn't want to offend the guy. But, I mean, it seemed kind of interesting to me. But, you know, look around for these interesting things. Their weirdness is what makes them attractive to editors. Focus on your specialty, which I think some of the others talked about, but also think about expanding to other specialties and getting a wider audience, I mean a wider universe. Read some newspapers, watch some TV news, subscribe to some magazines. And even when you're doing something like watching TV, going to a movie, or listening to a record, don't just put yourself on automatic pilot, but analyze these things. You know, Wall Street, great movie, very entertaining. Guy won an Oscar. What's his name? Michael Douglas. So on pure entertainment level, it's great. But that is a profound movie with some great moral statements about what's important in America and what's not. So even in pop culture, you know, try to digest some of that. Think of angles. Conferences and events. There are a lot of things that happen here. You know, whether it's SDI. Talk to Betty Skinner and get a list of her of all the things they have here at Glen Eyrie. There's a ton of stuff happening here every year. Conferences, Christian conferences. Go to some of the local headquarters of Christian organizations, of which there are already about 10, in which there are two more coming to town. You know, find out what's happening at Compassion, at Young Life, at Navigators, at International Students. In fact, Steve Sorensen, sitting back there on the floor, has 10 story ideas that he would love to give all of you on International Students that are guaranteed to make you rich. Serve as a roving editor, a man or woman about the world, in search of new and exciting trends. Research assistant. Maybe you've got a big fat file on something that, like astrology, that's been sitting in your file cabinet. Suddenly, with the Reagans going to astrologers, that has a new relevance. Maybe you can call somebody and say, hey, I know this Joyce Gilson or whoever it was who claims to be the Reagan's astrologer. Let me do a thing on this. Trends. I think a lot of us think that since we aren't in the White House, we don't know about trends. But I think you can pick up on a trend in your own Bible study or in your own church or in your own nuclear family or whatever. Because if a trend is happening, it's happening in a lot of places, and maybe you'll pick up on it before somebody else. And basically, eyes and ears. I think you can be aware and sensitive to the thing that the editor, because of his time limitations, geographic limitations, maybe intellectual limitations in some cases, cannot keep track of all these things, but maybe you can help. And I also think, with a servant attitude, if you go to an editor with a servant attitude, how can I serve you? How frequently would you like to hear from me with ideas, and in what format? And think about your communication skills with the editor, who's your first audience. And if you do these things, you will be a star. Okay, so that is all the formal stuff, and the Time Awareness Committee has been gesticulating. So you want to talk about query letters for a minute? Go ahead. What do you want to say about them?
I want to ask you specifically something. I think of myself as a creative writer, so when it comes to the business letter, I'm terrified. And I'm afraid that he's going to react like my husband often does and say, why don't you just get to the point? You know, just tell me what you want. And I don't know how long to make it. And I don't know how much... I'm afraid I'll muff my story because they'll think, oh, what a dumb letter. You know, I don't even want to read what she's written. So I would like to know real specific things. Link, what to include. And also, if it's a cover letter, that would be different, right, than a query letter, because obviously you're sending in what you've already done. So could we talk about the two different
Steve.
Things? I'm just going to say, can you repeat your question for the people on the
table? Okay. Question was, gold or silver in today's changing market? I'm sorry. Okay, the question, apparently there are some marital communication situations. I'm sorry.
Is this editorializing?
How long should the query letter be and what should be in it? Is that fair? I don't like a letter longer than a page to begin with. And I think the query letter and the cover letter are the same thing. I mean, I think in this case, your letter is doing it all in one shot. Some of the best examples of letters, I think, are junk mail letters, which we all get more of than we know what to do with. I got one yesterday from IDS Financial Planners. And the guy said, boy, it's May 5th. Do you realize that most Americans work until May, until they're through paying their taxes? And that's why you need a financial plan. And it doesn't have anything to do with anything, but boy, it sure would grab me, because that makes me mad, the fact that I worked the first 4 years of the month. But he had it all there in a page. Now, a lot of junk mail letters go on and on. But I think those are some good models, because those are hired by guys who have budgets and are supposed to return X percentage of responses per dollar or whatever. If I was to outline a letter, which I think I'll do, we're talking about 54 lines or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Around there?
Mm-hmm.
And let's take off the first three or four for white space. Then you've got four lines for address. Another couple lines for white space. Another date. Another couple blank lines. And salutation. How many lines are gone already? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We got about 15 of these puppies gone already. So now we've got 39 maybe. Let's start from the bottom. You've got maybe your name down there with a signature and a little bit of blank space before the close. So there's about 6 to 8 lines. So we got 33 to 31 lines. Now, there are a couple things that don't have to go here if you have them. One is a qualifications presentation, which I think is best made as a separate piece. And like I said, in my case, it's a 2-page list of stuff I've written. And that would also be clips and things like that. Now, what you can do in a case like that is reference that material somewhere. I've been writing for 5 years, and my work has appeared in Spittoon Collector's Journal, and this and this. You know, just tantalize them there. And then
what
say,
do you say if you haven't been published?
Okay, I'll get back to that in a second.
Okay.
But if you do have the stuff, again, just put enough here to tantalize, as Rosemary said, but then put the bulk of that material on the following page. Now, if the article is written and you're enclosing that, you can also just reference the article and just tantalize with the article, because the article's there for itself, and if it doesn't do what you say it does, no point trying to sell the guy in the letter anyway. So let's say we've got three or four lines on the qualifications, three or four on the article, and I like to indent paragraphs and leave a blank space in between. And that's just a personal preference, but again, if I receive a letter and that puppy is crammed to the hilt, and they used, which is the elite, which is the little, I mean, it's like, be nice to me, you know? I mean, look at this more as a proposal, as a confession or something like that, you know, where you're bearing your soul. So, we had 31 lines, and we've used four each for these, and we have three blank lines around there, so that's 11 lines right there, and we still have 20 lines left then for a nice greeting, a nice close, and maybe some other intelligent comments, like Susan Machenik was saying about demonstrating your awareness of the publication or something like that. But you know what I would think if I saw this is that, man, this person can discipline themselves not to bludgeon me with all these words. But what they're doing is, in kind of a business sense, presenting a proposal as a writer to a publication about what they propose to do. And I kind of like that. Now, I don't believe in long paragraphs. I think if it's three or four lines, it's getting close to overkill. And, you know, so a lot of these things are personal preferences. But that might be something you would take an editor out to lunch. And there are enough of them in this town you could do that with. Say, hey, free lunch on me if you help me out for a half hour and take some query letters you're thinking about using or something like that. But see, how would you feel if you received something like this? A lot of nice white space, nice warm greeting. They spend some time to invest in you as a person, you know, the qualifications, the article, awareness of your publication, a nice warm closing, another investment in you as a person, nice signature. Phooey. I'd sign you up right there. Okay, if you haven't written anything before, I think you need to talk to her, chairman of the Do It Committee. And
I'm asking how you present yourself in a cover letter or a query.
Well, it probably has to be the article itself standing on its own feet, or the great idea or something. And I suggest starting at, you know, the lowest level in terms of circulation and coverage that you can. And at the Christian Writers Group a month ago, I suggested some of the suburban papers, you know, the Black Forest News, the Northern Light, Cheyenne Editions or whatever. No money involved, and even sometimes somebody brought an article that they had done that with, and this person, when they submitted the article, they said, if you have any questions, give me a call, here's my phone number, and that appeared in the newspaper. So there's not... But that's also an indication of what those folks are dealing with in terms of time, maybe other factors we'd need to elaborate on at this point. But I say, you know, pick a target that is in your suburb or your locality, or think of smallness and narrowness in other ways. Maybe your denomination or your church has a newsletter. I mean, start somewhere. That will have to probably be a letter with the article enclosed or just a great idea. But then, next time you've got that thing, which was in the newsletter or in the Cheyenne edition, which you can use as the next step. Stephen, did you have
anything? Do you want to address the fact of not being apologetic in your letter as an introductory writer? In other words, if someone sends in a quality article and they researched out what that editor, the kinds of articles that editor tends to use, you know, how do you feel about that? Do they have to apologize for not being published, or can they just go in there and say, you know, here it is, here's the article, what do you think?
Do you have a response to that?
I went to a seminar a couple of weeks ago, and there was an editor that spoke there to give us all ideas on how to submit things. And she said it's best not to mention you've not written anything before, because she wants to believe that she can depend on you. And if you say, I've never written before, I'm sorry, I want you to look at this,
then she feels like, I'm kind of nervous about dealing with them. If it doesn't say it, then she doesn't get as nervous.
Yeah. And Mary and I were talking at lunch. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah. I just had my first article published this week. And when I sent it, I accidentally wrote the letter the way you wrote it up there. I just had it. I went through the publication and I said, this is what I see and this is what I can provide. Are you interested? I think that there's a need for this. And the publisher, the editor, wrote me back a handwritten note. I was really surprised. I figured editors had somebody else send you something. And he sent me back a note saying, I really liked your article, and if I have space this month, I'll put it in. And I thought, okay, just wait it out. But I have a question on that. Now I want to.
And he did put it in.
Yeah, I did. And it was very nice. The columns were beautiful. I kept looking at it. I kept thinking, this can't be mine.
Which I think, Mary and I were talking about this, and I don't want to get into the whole thing, but I think sometimes the people who are writers are maybe by nature less schmoozers and out there aggressive type people. They kind of sit back on the sidelines and observe things. And I think that's a good quality, and that allows them to see some things that maybe the people out there schmoozeballing all the time don't slow down enough to see. But I think as a writer, it takes a certain kind of arrogance or something to think that you have something to contribute. And as I was saying to Mary, we're all children of God, and God has a purpose for all of us, and maybe we have something to say as a writer or as an observer of this life that may be of benefit to some other child of God. I mean, put it that way, I don't think it's arrogance. It's just your legacy as a child of God, that you have something to contribute to this whole pie, you know, same as everybody else.
I have one quick question.
Okay.
Now, I don't want him to forget who I am. You know, one nice article, and real pleased with it, and put me with all the people who've been writing columns for years.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want him to forget me. Now, what's the next step? Do I write him a letter and thank him and send him another article?
Again, if you just wanted to be humane and sensitive and all that kind of stuff, maybe you could just write him a little card. Very simple thing. It says, hey, that was beautiful and I really appreciate it. And that would be, because he doesn't have to analyze, respond, or do anything. All he has to do is feel good. One comment. We have about 5 minutes left. And you remember that sheet with this line down the middle and the plus and the minus? Now, I know some of you guys are sensitive. We've been talking about squelching. You don't want to squelch. But let's be strong. Let's help Steve out. Let's help Steve grow, huh? Tell me what I need to do. So while you're doing that, we will talk about a few more questions. Yes.
Carol.
How
do editors basically feel about freelance writers? Is there kind of a stigma there? Do they kind of like don't feel good about getting that kind of...
There's,
how much dependence do they have on freelance?
There's a logical fallacy in your question by assuming that editors are this monolithic group who all have the same feelings about anything, particularly freelance writers.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they feel in as many different ways about freelance writers as we do about ice cream or anything else in the world. Some publications have a lot of editorial staff people. Some, like Moody Monthly, have a large backlog of articles that are edited and ready to go. And as I understand, some articles even designed and laid out, ready to put into the next issue if something else falls through. So they can be a lot more selective. Also, there's a case where it's a magazine that used to be institutional, you know, a Moody Bible College, and it's kind of moved a little bit out more into the mainstream, but they still have a large amount of stuff coming in from Moody professors, Moody radio people, and stuff like that. There are a lot of other editors who, unlike what was being said back there, have somebody else do everything all the time. They don't have anybody else to do anything. There are a lot of one-man shops in the editorial world. They are maybe a little more dependent on people who can do what they say when they say, as opposed to super intelligent, super creative people. They just need to have the stuff there so they can put it in, get this thing to bed, and start working on the next one. But look at some magazines. Study fastidiously, as was said earlier, the magazines. And just look at the bios of the people. I mean, do they all show up in the editor's box, or are they all freelance people? And some magazines use a tremendous volume of freelance-generated material. And I think most of those people, they may hate you, but professionally they've adopted the attitude that they have to deal with you, so they'll do it anyway. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, yes.
Back when you were reading the things that editors told you, you said one woman appreciated having an article documented with footnotes. And, you know, when something appears in a magazine, there's no documentation that I've ever noticed. What, are you to document things to an editor? I've wondered about this myself.
I think the statement about documentation was from Discipleship Journal, in which there's a lot of scriptural stuff. Some of the scriptures will be included in the text, but I think a lot of times there will be a lot of scriptures that are just referenced, and there may be some stuff at the end. But I think generally, yeah, that doesn't happen in most consumer
magazines. So editors don't know where you got your information?
I don't think so. Has anybody seen Big Lights, Bright City?
Well, not... My experience with submitting to highlights for children and some of the children's magazines, if you're doing a nonfiction article, they want to know what your references are.
Yeah. The movie Bright Lights, Big City is not a great movie, but it's kind of funny. The main character, Michael J. Fox, works in the factual verification department of a magazine, which is kind of loosely based on New Yorker or something like that. And there are like four full-time fact verifiers. And he's working on an article by a guy about some electoral thing in France, and he's calling Paris. Apparently his resume said he knew French, but he didn't. And so as part of the de-evolution of this guy's life, he loses his job over that article. But I think most people assume that writers cover that. And I'd say except in cases of potential libel or anything like that, you don't really have to worry about it. But there are cases where you might say something and they print it, and there have been some legal cases where it comes back to the writer. That's not that common, yes.
Somebody asked about how you keep your name before the editor when you publish. I'm reading a book now. I can't even tell you who it's by. I got it from CSU Library, which helps a lot. But this fellow suggested that as soon as they publish one of yours, you send them a query letter real quick on another idea.
Well, I think what Mary was doing, if you have an idea, I'd go ahead and send one. But I still think it might be not, if you are just really happy with that, you might let them know that. Mm-hmm. And then another couple of weeks follow up. But I agree to keep things. And once you've got a relationship going, relationships are kept together by contact and frequency and things like that, so keep it rolling. Yes?
On the note of relationships, once you get going with one editor, if you're wanting to approach, which you probably are, other publications, what do you need to let that editor know as far as your other... Do they care? Unless you're trying to, sell the same article to a different publication, is there a reason to...
No, I don't think they're jealous. I think some are, but that's going to be a professional liability for them down the road. And I think if you query, multiple queries are fine. Query 100 places at once, and then select the responses you want, or even do two or three articles.
I've heard the opposite.
I'm saying a query. There's been times where I've queried three people and got three assignments, and I took upon myself the responsibility to make sure each article was different enough from the other, so if these did happen to overlap, the reader or the editor wouldn't feel ripped off by this thing. One time I tried that and got a nice little Xerox thing in the check out of some policy about multiple submissions, which I took as an indicator that maybe I didn't make them as different as I thought I had.